On January 13, 2009, Doctor of Anthropology and activist Jeff Halper spoke at Dalhousie University about the invasion of the Gaza Strip. This is part one of a five-part lecture series.
In 1997, Dr. Halper co-founded ICAD to challenge and resist the Israeli policy of demolishing Palestinian homes. As the coordinating director of ICAD, Dr. Halper has organized and led nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience against Israel's occupation policies authorities. Just last April, Dr. Halper was arrested by the Israeli authorities for the eighth time. He was protesting the bulldozing of the home of the Hamdan family in a Palestinian neighborhood in Jerusalem. This summer, Dr. Halper broke the Israeli naval blockade around Gaza when he sailed to Gaza aboard the SS Free Gaza with dozens of other peace activists. Dr. Halper travels extensively to build international support for ICAD and to strengthen international advocacy for Palestinian rights. In 2006, the American Friends Service Committee nominated Dr. Halper, along with Palestinian activist Ghassan Andouni, for the Nobel Peace Prize. Dr. Halper's most recent book is An Israeli in Palestine, which was just published in 2008. This book records his journey to discovering that he, an Israeli, was actually living in another country, Palestine. Without dismissing the legitimacy of Israel, he came to see that Israel is defined by its oppressive relationship to the Palestinians. Please welcome with me Dr. Jeff Halper.
It's really good to be with you all. This is my second time in Halifax, and I've gotten to know quite a few people. Not all of you, you know, I can recognize a number of you in the audience from the last couple days. So it's very heartening, really, to see this many people come out, to a lecture on this issue. And I think it indicates that people are more concerned about this issue than is presented sometimes in the media. I want to talk tonight, obviously, my main remarks will be around Gaza and the attack on Gaza and so on. But I want to put it in a context, because I think the attack on Gaza is much more significant than simply the attack on Gaza, which by itself is a tragedy. And I have to say, no matter what the reasons given, at the outset, I want to say it's a massacre, period. I mean, you have 1.5 million people who are basically unarmed, with the light weaponry, some of them, and it's like shooting fish in a barrel. We figured out tonight over dinner that Gaza, that, what is it, HRM, the Halifax Regional, municipality, is 14 times larger than Gaza. And yet Gaza has about 1.5 million people. So it begins to give you a sense of how small it is. There's no place to hide. There's no jungles. There's no mountains. There's no forests. There's no caves. And the fact that, I have to say this, and the fact that over the last 2 weeks, the people of Gaza have put up the resistance that they have is something that I think is admirable. And I think we have to recognize that. But like I said, I think Gaza has other global implications that I want to talk about. I don't want to talk super long, because I'd like to, I mean, there's a lot of people to have a conversation with, but I'd like to have more, some questions and interactions and so on as much as possible. So I'll kind of present some ideas. You know, one of the problems when you're dealing with this issue is you can't prepare a lecture. I mean, I've got about 10 different PowerPoint things and lectures, and the situation changes every day. So what I try to do, the best thing I can do, is to kind of share ideas with you and share my thoughts and to hear from you what you say and make it more interactive. So I'd like to talk tonight about what I call global Gaza. I've been working for a while on the concept of global Palestine in general. This is sort of something like an onion situation. You know, starting from Gaza itself, I want to radiate out and to see some of the implications of what this all means. First of all, you know, just to put it all on a map, this is a map essentially of what we would call the two-state solution. This country, from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River, can really be considered one country. I mean, the Palestinians call it Palestine, Jews call it the Land of Israel, your churches call it the Holy Land. Whatever you call it, it really is one integral unit. All these internal borders and differences are really artificial and don't mean anything in terms of the history and really where the peoples live. So this is a map of the two-state solution. And one thing you might ask yourselves in the beginning, from an Israeli point of view, what's wrong with this map? In other words, in this map of the two-state solution, Israel is on 78% of historic Palestine. Now, the two-state solution, in which we're talking about a Palestinian state alongside the state of Israel, as you can see, isn't a fair and just solution. Today, half the population of this country is Palestinian. And that's before any refugees return. Okay? So essentially, we're really talking about a majority Palestinian population. And yet, you know, we always hear about Barak's generous offer, which is an urban myth, but we hear about it. We never hear about the Palestinians' generous offer. And that is, in 1988, 20 years ago, before the Oslo process began, the PLO in Algiers formally accepted the two-state solution idea. In other words, the Palestinians said, and this is at a time when the PLO represented all the Palestinians, before Hamas, so we can't go blame Hamas now for this stuff. 20 years ago, the Palestinians said, we recognize the state of Israel within these borders, within really the 1949 armistice lines. We don't see its legitimacy. I mean, we don't recognize the legitimacy of the state of Israel. We still consider this Palestine, but in terms of a solution to the conflict, we recognize Israel on 78% of historic Palestine. Now, this is probably unprecedented in the history of colonialism, where a colonial people say 78% of our country we're willing to give to another people who claim it. I mean, I don't think that would happen in Canada, and that wouldn't happen anywhere. And yet, that's exactly what the Palestinians did. This is the meaning of the two-state solution. Meaning, then, that what the Palestinians are claiming for a state of their own is only 22% of the country. The West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. 22% of a small country. And the conflict could be resolved. Now, this solution, the two-state solution, was accepted not only by the Palestinians, it's been accepted by the international community. This is the basis of what we call the Roadmap Initiative today, It goes all the way back to UN Resolution 242 of 1967. This is a solution preferred by the international community, supposedly by the United States and Canada as well. This solution was also adopted by the Arab League in what's called the Saudi Initiative of 2002, in which the Arab League said to Israel, if you give up the occupied territories, we will not only make peace with you and recognize you, we will integrate you into the region. And I'll tell you something else. This two-state solution is accepted by the vast majority of Israelis. All the polls in Israel show that up to 70% of the Israeli Jewish public accepts the two-state solution. The idea of Begin and Sharon and Netanyahu, who's coming back, that this whole idea of a land of greater, the greater land of Israel, with the settlements and all of this, has never ever been accepted by the vast majority of the Israeli public. And therefore, from the Israeli point of view, this solution could work. So what's the problem? Why don't we sit down tomorrow morning and sign a peace agreement? The problem is Israeli governments. And I'm not going to get into a whole lecture about the Israeli political system, but essentially there's a huge disconnect between the governments, and when I say governments, I mean all the governments, Likud, Kadima, which is a kind of a phantom party, and labor, that's supposedly on the left, that all basically agree that the two-state solution cannot be, and instead are pushing to make the occupation permanent. So that it's Israeli governments, and really in a sense against the will of the Israeli public, that are eliminating the two-state solution. And just to kind of give you a certain idea of what that means, you know, I'm an anthropologist, and anthropologists approach the world from the ground up. So if I really want to know what Israel's intentions are, if I really want to try to understand what's possible politically, I got to look at the facts on the ground. You know, we give our organization, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, we give tours all the time to people, including journalists and diplomats, and we try to say to them, Israel's policy from before 1948, it goes back to the 1910s, it has been create facts on the ground, that the future borders of Israel or the political realities in the area will be determined by the facts on the ground. Israel does not leave anything open for negotiations. The idea is the outcome of negotiations is decided before we enter into negotiations. And that's what the facts on the ground do. And if you look at what I call the matrix of control, you'll see, I mean, I'm not going to go into the whole, I mean, if anybody can tell me how a viable Palestinian state is going to emerge from this, it would be really great to hear. But let me just show you, for a couple minutes, the elements of the matrix of control. Ah, that's great. Okay. Thanks. First of all, what Israel has done since 1967, Israeli governments, is to fragmentize the Palestinian territories. In other words, these brown areas, all the way through, are what we call areas A and B. I can't begin to convey to you the alphabet soup type of existence that Palestinians live in. Areas A and B are where about more than 95% of the Palestinians are confined. Areas A and B represent only about 40% of the occupied territories. In other words, the Palestinians are locked into 40% of 22% of their historic country, and then fragmented into 70 little islands.
Some of them are so small, you hardly see them.
All surrounded by checkpoints or earthen mounds that prevent movement. There are more than 650 obstacles to movement in the West Bank.
So Palestinians cannot move freely, either themselves or goods, from one island to another.
So that's the first element in this matrix of control.
The second element, I'm not portraying it on the map here, is what we call the closure,
an economic closure. In 1993, at the beginning of the Oslo peace process, there was no particular spike in terrorism, no spike in violence. We're entering a peace process. Israel imposed a complete closure on the occupied territories. Between 1967 and 1993, there was freedom of movement. Palestinians could go into Israel, they could work in Israel, they could take their kids to the beach, they could come freely in Jerusalem to pray at the mosques or the churches. There was no closure, even during the first Intifada. So it shows you that the closure is not connected to security. And that's a point I want to come back to. There was nothing to do with security. And that is that between 67 and 93, Israel's policy was to de-develop the Palestinian areas. In other words, Israel didn't allow any banks to open, Palestinian banks. It didn't allow agriculture to develop. On the contrary, about 1.5 million olive and fruit trees were uprooted from Palestinian orchards in that time. And since then, there's been hundreds of thousands more. Industry was never allowed to develop. And in fact, Israel used, and until today, uses the West Bank as a dumping ground, both for its own agricultural products and also for its wastes. For example, the urban wastes of Israel, you know, the raw sewage of Jerusalem. Jerusalem's a city. The Jerusalem area is about 1 million people. The raw wastes of Jerusalem go through the West Bank. The raw sewage goes through Palestinian villages that themselves don't have sewage systems, that are living basically in Israeli sewage. And then it goes down to the Dead Sea, and at the Dead Sea, there's a plant that cleans the water, and then that sewage is used for Israeli agriculture in the area of the Dead Sea and the Jordan Valley. Israel uses the West Bank for industrial wastes. Even, it hasn't been proven, but there's even it's even been suspected that Israel dumps nuclear wastes from its nuclear plant in Dimona, down here in the West Bank. But the West Bank has become an area of disposal for Israelis. So that the whole area has been de-developed. Come 1993, starting a peace process, we impose an economic closure over the West Bank. Before that time, between 120,000 and 150,000 Palestinian workers would come into Israel every day to work, because that's where the jobs were. There were no jobs in this scorched earth of the West Bank and Gaza. All of a sudden, that was stopped. And it wasn't stopped because of security. It was stopped mainly because Israel discovered a cheaper source of labor, and that is foreign workers. Israel has imported, at any particular time, like today, there are about 300,000 foreign workers working in Israel, from China, the Philippines, Thailand, Romania, West Africa, and they're all cheaper than you can pay Palestinians, and they leave. You know, you can get them out of the country when you want to. So that with this cheaper source of labor, Israel then closed the Palestinians into the West Bank and Gaza, really in a kind of a cage with no economy of their own. But the closure is also internal. The 650 checkpoints and obstacles I've mentioned in between all these islands of areas A and B. So that
so that, you know, if this had anything to do with security, you know, and if Israel presents everything as a matter of security, we're defending ourselves against terrorism, that's the mantra that explains everything. Well, here you have a situation where of the 650 obstacles to movement, only 17 are actually on the border between the West Bank and Israel. All the rest, I mean, what is that? 633 out of 650, roughly, because the numbers fluctuate, are inside the West Bank, preventing Palestinian movement.
This lecture by Jeff Halber was brought to you by CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax, Dalhousie Student Radio.